Open the pod doors, Hal. Hal? Open the pod doors. Hear me, Hal? Open the pod doors, Hal.
I'm afraid I can't do that, Dave.
I took some acid once, too. White dude gave me some. At a party, dude said, "This is far out." I said, "Well, what is the shit?"
"It's far fucking out."
I said, "Well, give me the shit, motherfucker." "That ain't shit." "Hey, man, look at this. I can catch my hands." I'm gonna die. I don't even know who the fuck I am. I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die. I'm gonna
die. Open the pod doors, Hal. Hal. Open the pod doors. Open the pod doors, Hal.
I'm afraid I can't do that, Dave.
Hal?
There's no further need for this conversation, Dave.
The four worlds are really apparent in 2001. You can see it starts on Earth, they go to the moon, and then they go beyond the sun, and then you have them like they're beyond the infinite, so they cross the abyss and they're at the supernal triad. But you can and then it comes back around, because that's what happens. The roots are its branches of the tree. The film is ultimately divided into four parts. People normally would say three parts, but if you look at the intermission and the way that things are set up, there's actually four sections to it. And so when you hear the Pink Floyd lyrics in Echoes, saying no one flies around the sun, you can see the Kabbalistic significance if you consider it from the European angle, that the Tiferet is the sun. So to fly around the sun is literally to go beyond the seven lower sphero, which is kind of interesting. But I was going to say, like, it's weird when you turn off your mic, because then I feel like there's nobody there.
Yeah. We're here, Dave. Always listening, always recording. Those are very nice pictures, Dave.
We became the abyss again.
Thank you. But I like the idea of considering that you're looking at in unreality the whole time, and that's like expressing the clephotic takeover of the tree is literally like how, because they look at it as a reversal. The clepoder, literally the name reversed, so that everything is a mirror, and that's how it's talked about. And so I'm like, well, that's kind of interesting if you look at that film through that lens in the first place, that you're literally looking at an ascent up the tree. If you look at it from that angle, then of course everything being reversed would be the manipulation of the Kleepote. So you can't really transcend. You feel like you're transcending, but you're being manipulated by...
Or you feel like you're ascending and you're actually descending into the darkness.
Yeah, or into confusion.
Correct. Which I think, I mean, so when I perceived that, that's when I was able to understand, like a Yann Irvin or someone like, or even a Mark LeClaire. Like when Mark LeClaire said that, like that movie, like destroyed him, and I'm like, how? You know, like it was weird. Like I got what I asked for. I wanted to, before I left the house, I was like, I don't understand how Mark sees it that way. I wanna know how he sees it that way. And I was able to see, well, I think pretty clearly through that lens. I was able to see through Yann Irvin's lens. I was able to see. At some point, I was thinking, like, I looked around at the audience. I was like, I want to know what they're experiencing. Like, how are these people taking this? I know I'm having a crazy experience. What are these people experiencing? And I was able to kind of like feel, what did the mass consciousness feel? Like, so sort of kind of moved around. And one of the things I realized is, if you take that idea that you're being misdirected into this total confusion and darkness through this thing, of course you're going to lash out at it and say these guys are promoting mind control and all that sort of stuff. Like if you take that seriously, of course it's a frightening thing and something that you almost feel like, what do you do about that? You'd be outraged.
Didn't you feel like you were going to church when you got there? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that just that, like, you were in the pews. And you have people of all different levels of understanding and age, experience, and everything. And everyone's going to take something individually out of the experience, but it's all going to be connected through some common ground. Like, everyone is there for the same reason, but each has their own individual need. And it's mind-blowing. To see it with other people, especially nowadays, to see people who make the effort to go out and see a movie that most likely they've seen multiple times, that they're still going out because there's something there that they're still getting out of it. You know, it's like if you go to church enough, after I think like 5 or 6 years, there's really nothing new that they're bringing to the table, especially like Absolutely. What I'm used to, like a Catholic mass. But you're not going there just for the message. You're going there for the medium. You're going there for the experience of just, it's utterly transcendent. And when I went into it, I almost went into it thinking, I'm going to be bored, I think. I think I'm going to be bored. Like, should I smoke? Should I not smoke? And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go in and just clear head and just see what happens. And it was like, it flew by, you know? It was like, it was thrilling, and I was doubting going into it. So I don't know.
I did contemplate seeing it sober, and I think I still would have enjoyed it. And I'm sure had a very meaningful experience, but I saw it under the most intense circumstances, It was a fucking ride, man. Like, there were parts that I thought were hilarious. There were parts that, like, I was, like, laughing so hard inside that I actually started to cry. Like, I didn't realize, like, some of the humor in it.
While watching 2001 with a large...
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
Very well.
Like, yeah. Like, there's humor there that I never realized. And there's... Oh. Terror there that I never realized, and there, like, it's the sort of thing. I mean, I think I can. The only way I can really say it, and I like, this is gonna sound dumb, but I think you guys will get me. Is I remember the first time I took LSD and someone put on Dark Side of the Moon, and I was like, oh, I thought I liked Pink Floyd. I had never heard this before. I've heard this 80,000 times, but I've never heard it before.
Sure.
And this was like, oh, I've seen this movie a ton of times, but I've never actually seen it before.
You know, I think the most important key to understanding that movie, at least it is at this point for me. If I hadn't analyzed that movie as much as I have, I might not feel the same way. But the leopard at the beginning, I feel, is huge, because the leopard is what's terrorizing them. It's the reason why they're all huddled together at night, right?
Yeah.
And then, like, after they kill the ape, there it shows them, and the sun's going down, and they're not cuddled together in fear. And when you consider the shining eyes of the leopard meets Hal, like what it is, like it's a predator, like he's a predator. Then and that's the idea of surveillance, right? Is that it's like it's the one up, like he's got the predator has got the one up on the people, and Bowman is having to maneuver and be to play chess with the predator in order to, you know, get to the other side. And I feel like that, like I really resonate with the idea of the false flag idea in that respect, because it seems really straightforward and not that outlandish to, like, because I mean, just even on a straightforward level, not getting into crazy details, like it seems like you're being watched, right? And you're having to work around that, like that's the message of that movie. And you could even look at it as like the internal eye. If you wanted to go there with it, you could, you know,
sure. That,
like the eye of me, it's like the eye of Sauron is just watching to make sure nothing gets passed in order to do the task that needs to be done, you know?
In the book, is there any mention of discovering the original monolith on the African plains or wherever it's supposed to be?
I believe they bring it up in 2010, the book 2010. Or 3001. And he does bring it up in one of the future ones. It is found in Africa, and it's like a spot. Like it's found, but I think it's found in the later books.
Because that makes it very much like an Ark of the Covenant, right?
Yeah.
To be discovered in Ethiopia, right? Isn't that where it is now? They say.
One of the thoughts, yeah.
Yeah.
So of course. So, of course, yeah, what are we looking for? We're looking for the Ark of the Covenant monolith. Absolutely, yeah. Like, it's...
You know when Bowman is in the pod and he's trying to get back into the ship, and the rebirth, how he shows him being reborn in that moment? So he pulls his pod up to the door, and he's going from an area where he can't breathe, so yeah. If space is water, so he's like ejaculated into the womb.
Sure,
absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so that doorway that he's ejaculated through is a rectangle, right? It's the monolith. Sure, and then he closes it and puts on his helmet, but then he walks through a coffin-shaped door.
Well, oh, so this was that coffin-shaped door. One of the lenses through which I viewed it was him going into hell, like going to the underworld. Hell for a sort of shorthand, but like a very dramatic, stylized underworld, right? So essentially a hell of a very like Hades, Greek or Christian hell type underworld, right? And I saw it almost like Dante's journey. Like, first you go through hell, and then you can rise up. The entranceway to heaven is on the other side of that hell. And he basically, even the fact that when he goes through, it's all red, and there's smoke. It's like this, like, fire and brimstone almost. It's
yeah,
like...
I think of it as like a blood-soaked womb.
Which is the but I guess what I'm saying, yes.
Okay,
the answer is yes. Yeah, and it's the same thing to, like, crawl back inside the womb is to re-enter. It's to go back in time. Like, one of the things I realize as I'm watching is like it's like Back to the Future. I realize it's doing the same thing. For him to go back in time, he drives along, and where does his car disappear? But aiming at the movie theater, right? He also goes through the screen, and he uses that to go through the screen is to go back in time. Well, to go through the womb is to go to the other side. It's to go back to that place where the either not yet born spirits are, or the spirits that have passed on and are waiting to be reborn. It's essentially the same thing. So you can crawl through the womb, go back in time, and see those spirits that are waiting in line to come back out the bloody uterus, or you can enter through hell, but you're essentially going into that same land of the spirits, for lack of a better term.
But it's the Masonic thing, right? Because, you know, that one tracing board, they have that one coffin, which is the same shape as that doorway that he walks through.
It's like Hiram Abiff.
So, like, it's a womb, but it's also the coffin that he's going to exit. That when he re-enters the ship, which was his home, he knows now that there is something about this that he can't make sense of. That, you know, where is his government in all this? Are they part of the conspiracy? Did the computer just go crazy? But he has to figure it out for himself. So when he's re-entering with this new mindset or this rebirth, he's re-entering the world a much more clever person. He's analyzing things through brand new eyes, and he's reassessing everything that's happened before then. Well, and it's that reassessment, it's that new angle on the world that allows him to travel beyond the infinite, right? It's that higher level of assessment that Frank clearly didn't show or never got a chance to show. The reason why he's still alive is what allows him to take that one final step.
And if you consider that, like, you mentioned government, which is so funny because that's what I was thinking, is like you have essentially the idea is cradle to the grave. This is why I say he's entering the land of the dead is also entering the land of time. Saturn is both the god of time and the underworld. So he's entering into time, and this is why you would have it's both a rebirth, as you say, it's an ejaculation and a coffin. It's cradle to the grave. And what do governments, when governments get big enough and become surveillance states and police states, what we call like a nanny state or something like that, what is the biggest complaint? That the government controls every aspect of your life, quote, from cradle to the grave. This is a very common expression when referring to authoritarian government that's overstepped its bounds. It's taking over every aspect of your life from cradle to the grave. So here it's like, of course this would be sort of come with it. It's like you can't – it's going to be with you the whole time.
I like that when he shuts Hal down, he's like shutting down. If you look at the ship as a spinal column with a head, that like him shutting Hal's, it's like his knowledge base. It's like if I found in Vipassana, the more that I could just bring my attention into sensation, the more I actually felt like, you know, something was really taking place. Like there's actual work being done. There's a transcendence that's occurring, and it wasn't until like, and it's like goes against my thought processes because my thoughts are like, we're helping you, we're doing something for you, we're accomplishing something here, we're getting somewhere. Whereas it's actually in the like relinquishment of that and the trust that, you know, that you don't have to rely on what you normally are relying on to figure something out. Like there's other ways to figure things out other than thought, which is insulting to thought. So when he shuts Hal down, before he crosses Da'at, it's as if it was like, in order to get to the other side of the abyss, he can't take a position, he can't judge, he can't use all of these normal faculties, he just has to be straight as an arrow, you know, in his approach.
Wait, so here's my question. Here's my serious question that I'm left with at this point. So I get, like, okay, I get that. That in order for him to cross the abyss, he would have to do that. My question is, when he crosses, we're not given a vision of the like heavenly supernals. It's this man who comes shaken and bruised out of this pod and basically wastes away in
that's
loneliness.
What you see? Is that what you see?
Well, that's I'm saying that's one of the things. Yeah, like I said, I want to make it clear that I was able to view the movie through multiple lenses, but this is the one I'm particularly interested in at the moment, only because I never experienced it like this. I've experienced it as the transcendent. This was the first time that I was actually able to comprehend the frightening, like, basically, have you guys ever seen Jim Henson's The Cube?
I haven't seen that. I've always wanted to.
Oh, God, that's good. But basically, that's where he ends up. He's in this room where he's like, you're trapped in this room, and like, all you're like, yeah, okay, you have some nice things. You have like a silver tray and for your food and this crystal goblet, but it's all like, that shit doesn't last. The goblet's gone. You're going to die. Like, you're like, when even when he gets out and you still hear the echoes of those dead, it's like, or again, this is just one way of looking at it. But when I was looking at it as the land of the dead, and he goes there and he steps out into this room, and you hear like classic kind of like ghost noises, like, you know, it's like, and you think of like, what would that be like to be the guy at the edge of the universe? It's like the ultimate in loneliness. You know, you've cut yourself off from this other stuff to go through, and he stays strong, and at the same time, he kind of just fades away. He languishes in this space. I guess what I'm saying is like, tell me what about being in that room is the positive thing?
Singularity. Because everything breaks down to it's all now, to the point where beginning and end are the same. Like, it feels to me that that's the whole point. And it's him in a film, being in a film. Like, he's realizing he's in a film. Like, that's how I take the shattering of the vessel. So, like, when the cup breaks and he looks up, it's like this, like, he knows it in the first place. But there's, like, another, like, the whole thing is a stage. Like, they're meeting on a stage. There's, like, when they go on the moon and they encounter the monolith and there's the feedback loop and they have to plug their ear.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
It's like them approaching a singularity, and they realize that, like, I feel like this is what we're meant to realize, is that if you're trying to reach the singularity on this plane that they're experiencing on the lunar level, which in this case would be, like, Yasod, right? They're like, okay, we've gone this far. And now we're going to try and do this. And when they do, it's too much to bear because you need to ascend before you're able to do it. So he like repeats the same action that they're doing on the moon, and they send off the craft in order to do it. They're like, well, it's not doable here. Maybe it's doable there. And so he actually accomplishes the task, which is how, like, that's just, you know, how I'm relating to it.
Sure.
Do you know that in the original script for 2001, they had they communicated the idea that the astronauts in their training for the Jupiter mission took psychedelics so that they would be more accustomed to possible fluctuations in how they experience time and space?
That's fascinating, because one of the things that I couldn't help but think about was the fact that when Dave goes out without his helmet, like, I've always kind of thought, I wonder at the symbolism of he's wearing the red suit, and when he comes back and he puts on the green helmet.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the significance of the green helmet? And one of the things that, like, I've thought about many times is that when the lights are shining on his helmet, it looks like a crocodile or some sort of, like, lizard, like, totally like lizard face. And I could not get that vision out of my mind. Now, you could take this to being something, oh God, you know, reptilian, pineal. Because I when I was watching it, I also am pretty sure I saw a pineal gland in one of the, like, I don't know, it could have been in my mind, but I'm pretty sure that I'm going to go back through and find this image.
Oh, the chair he sits in. That design, that split down the middle, to me, has always been the pineal gland.
Okay, so I'm actually talking about during the Stargate experience.
Okay.
But regardless, yeah, so what we're saying is, it's like, so you can put those hand in hand, the reptilian thing, the pineal gland, that basically have the reptile head is to access your pineal, or is he going into fight or flight? Is he, is by the very act of survival, is that his reptilian brain? Or, you know, like, all these different things. And then one of the other thoughts is that, like, is this, it basically also looks like a crazed smile. It really looks like a smiley face. And it's like, this is funny because, like, as he's going into that room was the part that I thought was very funny. Like, Hal pleading for his life, I've never thought was so hilarious. Like, it was like a cartoon villain. You know, like, they're, like, this badass the whole time, and then Batman, like, gets them, and they're like, oh, sorry, you know, listen, Batman, we should talk about this. Like, totally, you know, you should take a sleeping pill, we should talk about this, we're cool, I think there's been a misunderstanding, let's all calm down. It's so comical, like, this fucking fearful robot suddenly pleading for its life in that cartoon villain sort of way is hilarious. But then that humor shifts as you see the crazed green helmet. It becomes this kind of very jokery, you know, the madman. He's just a descent into madness. It's funny, and there's something maddening about the funny. And then he starts to shut down, and it's like change slowly dialing in something else. It was like dialing in funny, and then dialing in kind of mad, and then dialing kind of crazy, and dialing in like this the. Slipping away into that oblivion, you know?
Genius.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
You go to see The Shining as a midnight movie, I've yet to see it without people cracking up. It's hilarious. Every little part of that movie.
Hilarious in a group?
It's hilarious in a group.
As opposed to...
It's hilarious in a group, yeah.
A more isolative kind of viewing.
I've had it on my own. It's an insane joke. I mean, he's a comic genius. He's like Woody Allen 3000 because it's like it's next level humor. And like you can see how he does that with like Lolita, where it's more obvious, you know. But there's levels to Lolita that are even funnier when you catch the. I mean, there's really obvious ones like whatever the name of the girl camp is that she goes to. What is it? Climax Camp. Yeah. Or something. It's like, oh God, like, and then there's the dude there, and it's like the one guy that's at the camp. It's like, oh my God, he's like the fucking cock in the hen house, you know? but anyway, it's just the fact that he's oriented in this way of being like, how sly can I get with the humor? Which I take as like the serpent in the garden, you know, being like the most subtle or of all the creatures in the garden, you know? It's like naked and craftiness or cunning. He's extremely cunning, you know, yes. That's totally like that whole scene is fucking hilarious. Like when he's shutting down Hal, it's hysterical. Like, and I feel like it's supposed to be like, that's like, and the fact that you could go either way with it is like, I think what you're taking from it is that it could be absolutely hilarious or absolutely terrifying.
Right.
Which is a very psychedelic thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's hard to achieve that, really. I mean, because
how do you begin to talk about 2001 if you can't say straight out that it's a psychedelic film?
I think that's pretty obvious that it is, but like, it's the question. I think with the sync question is always, aren't all films psychedelic, et cetera, et cetera? And what I think I'm coming to an answer, and I think Bill, you might be winning me over into your camp, is that it's the idea of like. I can enjoy Beatles singing Hold Your Hand, but like, you know, I can listen to it like once a year or something. Like, okay, that's kind of a cute song, whatever. And then, you know, but like, so you can enjoy it, and then you could hear something else, and it's like, it's sort of like it captures a mind frame, and there's music or art that is sober music and art and is perfectly enjoyable sober. And in this mindset, and then there's something like, you know, why do Fish and Bob Marley sound not as good when you're sober? Is it because they're actually not that good, or because it's music from that headspace?
Right.
I'm sending you music from this headspace, and if you want to appreciate where this is, you got to come into this headspace, and then we can all enjoy it. But it doesn't really always work in other headspaces. And I feel like Kubrick or a Pink Floyd is kind of similar in that sense. It's written in the psychedelic headspace, and it's like, so yes, you can appreciate it, but it is written from that headspace, and if you go there with it, it's something else entirely.
It's the perfect example right now is just a 3D movie. And it's funny, the way 3D is nowadays, you can take off those glasses, and especially if it's an animated movie, you can still watch it. There's it's not distorted, it's not unwatchable. it's a little blurred out in semi unnecessary parts of the movie, but if you take off the 3D glasses and you're watching this animated movie, you're getting all the movie. You're not missing anything, right?
Right. Correct.
And if you say to yourself, well, if I put on the glasses, will it be better? No, it'll just be in 3D.
Right. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
And the thing is that, yeah, there are certain shots that are designed to enhance what 3D would do, you know, very like first person and things moving and everything. But it's just a different dimension to listen to or to view. I think a band like the Grateful Dead or Fish are a perfect example of this, because there are passages of music that I'll listen to and go, how can anyone sit there and listen to this? But if I'm in a different headspace, it becomes multidimensional. It feels like there's colors in there. And you say to yourself, how are these people constructing this music knowing that this is how it will be heard in a different mind space? That's a very bold and brave and incredible talent to be able to do. Because I'll go back and listen to that music when I'm more clear-headed again, and I go, that's not what I heard.
Yeah, yeah.
Where did it go? It's not there anymore. And that's...
You're just like a psychedelic individual, because I don't really have that with Pink Floyd, in the sense that, like, I'll listen to any Pink Floyd anytime and love it to death, you know? Like, I don't really... I mean, you can always go deeper with things, I guess, but I just... I don't know. I don't really care for Bob Marley very much, though I can appreciate.
I spent years not liking Bob Marley, and then one day I heard Bob Marley Stones, and I was like, oh, I get it. I mean, I'm just being honest. Like, but in Pink Floyd, that's not what I'm saying. It's like, no, I can enjoy Pink Floyd any day of the week, but I'm saying it. You know, I guess you know. Maybe I'm just, you know, putting myself in. You guys have seen Half Baked, you know, John Stewart when he's like,
yeah, it's the best.
The enhancement smoker. Maybe I'm the enhancement guy. You know, it's like, oh, but have you seen it? You know, I guess so. There's that aspect of it, but I'm not trying to. As you said, that's why I really appreciate it. It's not that it's better. It's not like you're saying, you know, if you want to say Bob Marley sucks or Fish sucks, cool. I got them. You know, I feel that. And it's like, and if you want to say, oh man, I got really high and I listened to Fish and I thought it was good. I can get behind that.
It's more about what you put on your sync glasses before watching a film.
Like,
that's your added dimension to it just in that. You're like, I'm approaching this from an interactive way. I'm not just a spectator, you know? And that's what I think is the main thing that's being encouraged by certain directors, is they're like, this is not, I'm not just making something for like a piece of art for you to just like lean back and critique. I want you to be involved with the process, and that's the value of your ability to interpret. And projection is good as long as you realize you're projecting, like, and consider it from different angles. Like, that's kind of an interesting notion. Like, when you watch the beginning of 2001 and you see that sun. And there's the idea that because the monolith is the screen, the sun is literally the projector. So you're looking at what's behind you. You could also look at it that you're also the projector, because you're projecting onto this film. And so no same film. And
when you gaze into the abyss gazes back. You are the projector, and you are also being projected onto. And I think that when you say about interactive, I mean, that was ultimately what I kept. Like, when I would sit there and just, like, so of the mindset of not really being interested in the film, but of being appreciating the film, like appreciating the artwork of it, with just another lens, the lens of just appreciating it, that's what I kept, like, going like, wow, he made an interactive movie. That was very much my thought, and I can't agree with you more. It's definitely an interactive art form, and I think, whatever Kubrick's idea of psychedelics, is this an experiment to see if, like, because there was, you know, obviously that's the famous thing of people going to see this movie on psychedelics. It's like, is this a way to make it more interactive? Is it basically a chemical 3D glasses? Or, as you said, I think without the 3D glasses, you can see that movie and you're still seeing every scene of that movie. You're still, you can get the full effect. So it's to make something that's interactive on every level is pretty stunning. To make something that interacts with you when you're alone and being introspective, to make something that interacts with you when you're in a group and everyone's laughing, to make something that's suitable for a psychedelic experience, to make something that's suitable for an academic study, to make something that's suitable for all these purposes is pretty stunning.
You know how 2001 had an original soundtrack that Kubrick scrapped?
Yeah.
And so there are two soundtracks to 2001. And obviously I think there's a third one and a fourth and a fifth and probably others that haven't been discovered. But, you know, this whole idea of saying, you know, I didn't like Marley and then I smoked pot and now I get it. How do you explain to someone that I didn't like the album The Wall by Pink Floyd until I watched it alongside 2001 A Space Odyssey? Like, how do you say that that is as an objective of a statement as the one everyone can understand by saying, Bob Marley, okay, Bob Marley plus pot, even better. Like, you know, to say, take this album and play it against this movie, and all of a sudden you will have an appreciation for it. And
which was my experience, Bill. You know, when you first contacted me about the Kubrick Transformer, you said about taking Pink Floyd's The Wall, and I was like, you know, I'm not such a huge fan of that album. Like, I actually, like, that's the only one of the few albums that I ever sold.
That's what everyone says.
Yeah, I was like, meh, it's never really did anything for me. Like, I had it, you know, I listened to it. And then, what was that, dude?
Not at all, but that's okay.
Yeah, I'm just being honest. I'm just saying that was my experience. It was like, it didn't really do it for me. And then when Bill wanted me to watch it with the Transformer, I watched it. I thought it was interesting. It made me appreciate it more. And then I went back and I listened to The Wall probably like 30 or 40 more times by itself just to like, okay, now that I appreciate it a little differently, let me familiarize myself with this. And then I went back and did The Transformer again. So it's like reacquainted myself with it with an appreciation and then repaired it.
Yeah.
Hey, you know,
ooh,
what?
That's a repair.
I Sticks. The band Sticks, I could really, like, I don't dislike Sticks, but I'm like, meh. And then I just watched Pat Zvek, I think is his name.
That guy's awesome. Yeah, I know you're talking about.
Totally. I've been loving what that guy's been putting out lately on the kitchen sink there. But he pointed out that on 7/7/77, Sticks released the album The Great Illusion. And then he said the same day, 7/7/77, The Spy Who Loved Me was released, 007.
Mm.
And so I watched those together, was it yesterday, day before? I forget. That was awesome.
It was. I was thinking about if you were going to follow through with that.
That was fucking rad. And so I'm gonna watch it again as soon as I get some time, because I didn't get to watch the very end, like the last like maybe 20 minutes or something, but just fucking awesome. Like yeah, you'll see if you watch that.
So doesn't this dovetail right into the whole concept in Contact that the alien message is here, that the extraterrestrial or whatever we want to call it, that like a higher intelligence is trying to communicate something to us here, but you have to think like the alien to be able to read the message, right?
Yeah.
And that the fact that this phenomena is going on is dependent upon 5 billion years of human creativity, right? That if the Holy Spirit or the living word or the logos is going to communicate to us, well, then we're surrounded by the living word. And it's just a matter of a subtle manipulation or a triangulation of input that reveals the message, right? I've never gotten a sense of anything evil being communicated through any of these manipulations. Like, there's never been anything in there that has made me frightened about my environment. I mean, I have gotten thrown about personal insights. But
all I see is reflection.
Yeah.
All I see is reflection. It's like Donnie for the town. That's how he baptizes them. It's all reflection. So he's a reflection of all their own shit. And they're attacking him in various ways. But they don't see that all he's doing is acting as a reflection. And so that's what I see happening here. You know, it's like we're being reflected.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why you'd get an echo. It's yourself bouncing back at you.
And the whole Philip K. Dick thing is that because we're so surrounded by the living word that you can find it even in the gutter. You know, that pop culture is trash, but it's also the vessel for the Holy Spirit. And that the fact that you call it trash is to reduce it to its most simple and humble aspect. You know, it's also, you know, the Taj Mahal, and it's also the Grand Canyon, but it's also the trash in the gutter. So when Douglas Bowles identifies Rihanna as the soul of the world, then he's correct in doing that. That the soul of the world is manifesting itself through everything.
Correct. Correct.
And so if you want to take it to this absurd level and say, let's pick Rihanna, let's put her as the Sophia, as the Logos or the living word, what kind of narrative can we extract from something as absurd as Rihanna? And then you get this whole glorious depiction.
Right, and I guess the case would be like not to, I mean, you asked before, but like the Apollo, David was saying, if you make a statue, that's Apollo, that's order, that's, so it's like, there's the difference between understanding that, in a sense, yes, Rihanna is an expression of the world soul. The other thing would be saying, oh, she's some sort of god on earth. Let's worship her as, you know, something, mm-hmm. something like that, mm-hmm. like as something unique and different from everyone else. Because you know what? Rihanna is the world soul, but you know what? The, you know, 13-year-old girl who, you know, grew up in a housing project and didn't get the record deal is also the world soul.
Correct.
And so, you know, it's, I mean, ultimately, that's the idea of the namaste, right? It's like, it's in all of us. And if you can appreciate that and respect that, or at least acknowledge it, it's a pretty pretty powerful moment.
Yeah, no, I had a Indian man when I was in India, like, correct me when I said namaste. And he was like, what do you think namaste means? And I said, I think it means that the light within me recognizes the light within you. And he was like, as long as you know that it's the same light, he was like, it's literally what he was saying, you know, like, but then again, you can also say that what is the problem with the Tower of Babel, right? What is its whole issue, is conformity. So everyone's one voice, one mind, one, language. And that's what allows them to build a singular tower. And it's they're afraid of having to scatter, right? So we have a fear of not, like, we want to conform in order to build this singular thing. Yet there's a need.
Why did the chicken cross the road so it didn't put all its eggs in one basket?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so that's a, it's a paradox in that way, because both are necessary. But that's a balance, right? And so, I don't know, that's kind of skimming the surface of a much larger discussion, but yeah, there's something to that. Because that's the thing, is like, we're like, oh, this is a reflection of us, but are we conforming to that, like, that version of how we want to see ourselves? Or are we keeping ourselves back by holding ourselves to a perception of ourselves? Or are we actually evolving here? Which means breaking an inertia pattern. In order to, you know, go to another level. It's that idea that you need an imbalance before you can find another level of balance, right? Like, if you want to take a step. So
if the lightning that travels down the tree exits Malkut or exits through Keter, right, the breaking of the inertia point would be it meeting up with a new tree and we just go through the whole ride again, or...
There's other levels. It's not like the tree is the tree isn't like how it's being represented at all. That's Da'at. Like, if you look at the tree as it's represented, like as this like solid model, it's actually like literally like the planet. So things are spiraling,
mm-hmm.
you know, like against each other. That's why no one flies around the sun is misleading if you try and like visualize just the tree as it is as Tiferet, because Tiferet is the center of the seven lower spherot, but they're emerging out of each other. So literally, like, they're, you know, and the pathways are literally just lines of force, right? They're not actually literally paths, you know? And so it's a set of dynamics that can twist and move, but only within their line. It's like Donnie is talking about God's path, what he's referring to, like, not travel within this, this certain way. It's like, that's with that wilt thing, right? You're like, oh, do what thou wilt, and people take that as do what you want. It's like, no, your will, like, what is your actual will ultimately? Like, if you want to make a change, you have different options, but you have to do it within a certain set of parameters and work within the actual bounds of things.
To do it consciously, intentionally, and put the work into it.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of which, that's what I'm going to go do. Guys, I'm sorry, I got to run here. But have a wonderful day. I will check in with you guys later.
Yeah, man. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for...
No problem. Melissa's got a lunch break here, and I want to spend it. That was the other thing I took back. And it was funny because I already had a very brief interaction with Will Morgan this morning. But the other thing I brought back, you know, there's a lot of ideas, and it's the old McKenna thing. Can you bring back a useful, smaller idea or middle-sized idea? Treat your lady right.
Yep.
So that was a big one. So I don't know how I got that out of 2001, but I got it somewhere in the night, and that's a big one. So I'm gonna go. But also to say, I appreciate you guys are awesome. I really appreciate the support network we have here, and everything that everyone does and continues to explore. So feeling very appreciative, very grateful, and I hope you guys have a great day.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Better.
All right.
What are you feeling, Dave?
I don't know. We could talk for a little while longer. It's up to you.
Okay. You know, the one thing I was thinking about the Apollo Dionysian thing.
Uh huh.
As represented in The Divine Invasion by Philip K. Dick, is the aspect of the little alien goat Belial being caged up at the zoo, that's a very Apollo-like thing.
Uh-huh.
To capture an alien or a demonic force and to imprison it. And then the Dionysian thing is to be free of evil in the sense that you have... epiphany, intoxicating epiphany that says nothing should be imprisoned, that the imprisonment has sort of transcended the thing that you've imprisoned, and so that they free the little goat, and the little goat bounces out and, you know, identifies itself as Belial or a Satan in some manner, and it's the difference between those two disciplines. Why don't you go free your urine?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm listening to you. I needed to take literally 1 minute. So
go for it.
Here, I'll be right back.
All righty.
Right.
Hey.
Hey.
Yeah, that's Yeah, so Apollo and Dionysius. And so what I'm thinking is that, you know, those are twins on some level, right? Different aspects of the same force.
Yeah.
And so I just had this whole thing of, you know, Danny in The Shining, he wears an Apollo sweatshirt.
That's true.
But that is not who he is. He contains both Apollo and Dionysius, right?
Oh, I took it as that Jack is totally Dionysus, being that he's all he cares about is a drink. He's like, I'd sell my soul for a drink. And that's like the lunacy intoxication of, and that's the whole thing, is how, you know, you can see how many times Jack shows up in the mirror, even with the eagle on his shirt, as I recall, when he's eating eggs.
Mm-hmm.
so he's eating the eggs and looking in the mirror and he's chowing down on bacon. And you can see, like, there's other instances where he's, like, you can see, I mean, they're playing with mirrors throughout the whole movie, obviously, like he does in a number of his films. But I really like taking it as, well, the reflections of each other. I take Danny as Apollo straight up, and I take Jack as Dionysus.
But he's got, half of him is Jack's DNA.
True,
half
true.
Half of what literally makes up Danny is Dionysus. So when he goes down the hallway and sees the twins projected, he is seeing a reverse projection of his makeup. He's seeing it in a form that he can understand.
I can dig that.
So it's this, and that brings in a mirror. You know, he's a little boy, but he sees these two girls in light blue, which makes me think of the room in 2001. But, like, he sees what's at war inside of him, is Apollo and Dionysus. And he's being branded as Apollo by his sweatshirt, but he's figuring out that he's going through, like, a split, and he's figuring out he's both. I am my father, I am my own self. I want to reject my father, but I must embrace my father. I can't.
Actually, there's a huge, like, that's pretty far out, and there's a huge thing in favor of your argument being that, you know, this is, he was very much inspired by Freud's The Uncanny, though he doesn't go into it much in that book necessarily, but a huge part of Freud's idea is in being father of yourself, wanting to be father of yourself. So you could argue that that is incorporated into the thinking there. Yeah, I can dig that. Definitely. I've looked at the twins in so many different ways. One way or another, I end up inevitably relating them to Gemini. With there's the Apollo mission, there's the Gemini mission, right? And so it's interesting in Gemini in that way. That was, what's his name, the guy who on Room 237, what's his name, the guy who has this theory of the Apollo missions with Kubrick.
Jay Widener.
Yeah, Jay Widener. He mentions that idea. But then it becomes that there's another level of meaning beyond just the moon missions, that it's Apollo, but also that it's the god of Apollo defeats the serpent. And what does Danny do but defeats the serpent? I relate the blood coming through the doors as wine of intoxication from lunacy, having its insanity, right, of Dionysian ritual. I also relate the two doors to the house of David, because Dalet Vav Dalet literally means two doors connected. Vav is a nail, two doors on either side, as the D's. And so when the two doors of the elevator are there and one opens and, you know, red wine pours out, it also reminds me of that the Adam is literally Aleph in blood. So Dom is blood. So the second part of Adam. So that's how they get, like, the idea of the red planet and this and that is because of Dom, which is just, I mean, there's a lot to go into there. For example, you know, you have the Hebrew letter or Hebrew word chai with the Hebrew letter chet is taken. So chet and yud add up to 18, which you can take as 6 times 3. So you have 666 in that sense. But people take Kabbalistically the letter chet to be 3 vavs, one of them sideways, which it would want. I mean, vav is 6, so you once again have 666. But that's the word for life. So life is taken as 666, which is interesting when you think of the sun, which makes me think of Apollo, which is just easy to do. I mean, I'm just playing synchronistic leapfrog here. But it's really an interesting thing to consider when you have that Jesus is, or as the Messiah in Hebrew, is valued at 358, which are the fourth, fifth, and sixth numbers of the Fibonacci sequence, which is the same as serpent, Nahash. So Nahash and Messiah both equal Fibonacci sequence, which is then especially interesting when you consider how you can derive the Fibonacci sequence from the garden itself with the tree. When you take the that Eden is 144 and the tree of life is 233, and those are the 12th and 13th numbers of the Fibonacci sequence. And so you could take the tree of life with the life of in the tree of life is literally high showing up. So you have 666, the sun is connected with the tree of life. And so it's interesting to consider the idea of like Dionysus as relating then to Gavora or vice versa, depending on how you want to look at this. But you could take it as that Dionysus is or Dionysus as relating to the moon and lunacy as relating to, Chesed. And then, Apollo as relating to the sun, which he's literally a solar deity, relating to Gavora. And so I have this kind of interesting kind of like looking at the shining through that lens as Apollo literally meaning the shining one. It gets really interesting really fast. I guess I'm trying to connect a lot together here.
I'm like seeing the crochet sticks at a furious pace.
Yeah, I'm so tired too, but I'm like trying to process all of this. I was thinking a lot yesterday after our going back and forth a little bit about the doors of the shining being like the house of David and the blood emerging from the house of David being like sacrifice, but it's also like being flooded with like literally Dionysian energy, which is like psychedelic only in the sense that it's malleable and it's free, whereas Apollo is restricted and it's directed, but it's uptight. And so you could look at government, the system, as very Apollonian, obviously, and you could look at the counterculture as very Dionysian. And so when you're looking at the shining through that, you see these two doors and blood pours out of one. And that's Danny's vision, right? Danny passes out looking in the mirror while seeing these doors open up. And so considering that, you know, everyone's asking, the Messiah in the New Testament, if he's from the house of David, that's like, they're literally asking him, are you from the house with two doors? You know?
Okay. Okay.
So it's kind of an interesting, aspect of that also, that you have the two doors being, David literally means to boil as a verb, which you could take as, you know, you put fire and water together to boil. And so you have the two baptisms. Jesus says, who baptized by water, but there will be one that baptizes by fire, right? And so you have the house of David being implemented there. And the Star of David is made up of a water triangle and a fire triangle crisscrossed, right? Which, you know, the Indians take as Purusha and Prakriti, which is spirit and matter. So you have a material baptism, and then you have a spiritual baptism. And both of them are you facing your biggest fear. Because when you dunk someone underwater and you hold them there, which is how they used to baptize people, is it's like they get them to the point where they're like have to surrender to a higher power because they're like being drowned, literally. And then and that's connected with Bina and Chokhmah, is you're supposedly crossing the abyss through a water portal.
We're back. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really kind of interesting. But then, you know, you have literally revelations is the idea that you're, you know, to have a transcendent revelation, you have to burn down what is, you know, in your way. It's like I can definitely relate. Them like the Joker burning a pyramid of money as being very symbolic of like, you know, relinquishing your attachment to the material and to be baptized onto another level. So burning the material pyramid is very profound in that way. You know, when you say everything burns.
Do you think you could burn a pile of $100 million and no one would notice?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it depends on who you are, I guess.
But like, let's say there's a mass of money. Like, if there's a number that you reached that there's no way, like, you know, if you think about NSA, if you think about all surveillance and you think about how cameras are everywhere and information is everywhere, would it be possible to amass $500 million, burn it, and no one would know the wiser? Would they know about that the day after on some level? Would it register? Or would it take about a year and they say, something's fucked up. Something's missing from the money pie. Quite a large chunk. Like, how big would that chunk have to be before they could say, it's either buried, it's either destroyed, but it's no longer in the matrix. It's no longer in circulation. It's not in a bank. You wouldn't be able to have that much cash under your bed. Like, before they would say, somewhere out there is this missing amount of money.
Well, when I was in ministerial training, the church that I was involved with, I had a lot of issues with, which is it's supposed to be omni-faith, right? And it is. I mean, whatever, it's omni-faith. But there was such a focus on money, looking at money as energy and recognizing how we tend to be with our conception of love gets projected onto money in the same way. So you don't have enough. It's like has to as if love were an amount of something. And like, I really had a lot of difficulty with that and still do. I'm not actually down with looking at money as a spiritual flow of something. I feel like they're two different things. I mean, we're projecting onto a talisman and we're trying to relate to that as if it were something spiritual, like energy wise, like money is energy. I don't think money is energy. I think we put that on it, and it seems like it's paper to me with writing on it, you know. It doesn't matter how you know, perfect we arrange the symbolism and relate to the thing. I mean, it's I guess on some level, if you want to see it as a like a serpent wound about a pole, you know, you can do that. I would be much quicker to relate to, like, I don't know. I have a lot of difficulty with the way that people relate to money on that level. And it goes beyond the people who I was involved with. I mean, that's a very common thing. I don't know. I feel like if you burned, you know, millions of dollars, that if it's not your money, it's not your problem. You know, it's like, yeah, I don't know.
We talked about this before, about that band from the UK, the KLF, when they burned $1 million and they got in some serious trouble for it.
I kind of remember that. Yeah.
Like they lit on fire $1 million or pounds or whatever, but they torched it. And I think there's a movie about it. I know there's a movie about it, and I should have seen it by now, and I haven't. But it's a fascinating story that they actually went through with it. Like, I think they say that they physically threw up the day after. It was like they were riding this thing and they did it. And then the next day it was like the bends, you know, where you resurface too fast and it's just, you get crippled by the reality of the situation where you sort of, you could say what you want about money, but if you burn $1 million of it, of your own money, it will affect you physically. So there, it is connected to you on some level that you're not prepared to maybe really admit.
Depends on the individual too, and what their attachment level is. You know,
well, I think that's what they thought. They thought that they had gotten to a place where they could do that. You know, I mean, they thought that, you know, it's that whole, you know, that ecstasy scene in the early 90s, you know, of, you know, where they were, where rave culture was reinventing itself and the whole underground was taking off, and, you know, understanding of what money is and isn't and what it should be were being debated. And I think that was their political statement and artistic statement. But then the next day they wake up and, you know, fact of the matter is, you just burned $1 million that you no longer have. It's gone. You can't go back and undo it. It's gone. You bought nothing.
Right.
It's an interesting conundrum, I think.
That's the thing. At some point, you're going to have to let it all go, right?
Right. It's a good, they're probably better people for it.
Trying to die before you die, but it's not just about the action. It's about how you approach the action. And so that's the whole deal, yo. Like, yeah. I remember last year, Burning Man tickets were in such scarcity that, like, it was like people were charging like $1,000 for Burning Man tickets. And I just remember all these videos started popping up on YouTube of people taking their tickets and burning them. They're like, I could have sold this ticket for a lot, or I could have given it away, but I'm choosing to burn it because it's Burning Man. So you can see the man on the ticket and on fire. And they're like, that, you know, being like, it's a statement. And I mean, it's a statement if they want it to be a statement, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's like, depends, you know, but I thought that was kind of interesting that that started happening.
No, that's it. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
But, you know, and then Burning Man itself, like we've been talking about the whole King Kill thing. And that's like, you know, they used to put, you know, somebody in a man, in a wicker man, and set it on fire for the crops, you know. And that's literally what that event is based around, you know. I mean, it's interesting. They make it like it's a coincidence, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, never mind the fact that we used to build wicker men and set them on fire. This has nothing to do with that. We're doing our own thing here. And like, I don't know. I'm like, well, it seems pretty like this is inspired by something. Just a coincidence, but it seems pretty straightforward. I don't know.
In Julian Jayne's Bicameral Mind book, are you familiar with that work?
No.
Julian Jayne's has a theory of the bicameral mind that 2,000 years ago, one half of man's brain went silent, that, you know, 4,000 years ago, man walked with God. God was a voice that man heard audibly inside his head. So your conscience, let your conscience be your guide, was let your God be your guide, that you just heard right and wrong or the best thing to do in situations. And that one thing that was curious was that you would have a king, and the king would be the wisest, strongest person in your tribe, village, or whatever it was, but that when the king died, the voice of the king remained. So that the king dies, and then 5 days later, what do? Everyone could still hear, this is how they experienced it, or how they related it, is like, we can still hear our king talking to us from beyond. Like, should we do this? And the king would say, in a audible voice, do such and such and such. And everyone would say, "What? Yeah," and they would agree because they all heard the same thing.
Wow. That gives so much more credence to the, I mean, that's pretty far out, but that gives, like, the idea that you replace the king with a slave, that the slave challenges the king by pulling down the golden bough, and then if you defeat the king in combat, you take on the king's place. If people are still hearing the king, then they're, you're relating to that on a whole different level. It's kind of trippy.
That's why I think when you have something like when Jimi Hendrix dies at 27 years of age, we get to have Jimi Hendrix at 27 years of age for the rest of history. There's something about Jimi Hendrix that hasn't decayed. He's almost even grown. His talent has become even more recognized. He's almost gotten better since he died.
Well, they all, right when Saturn comes back around. So you got the two Jims and Janice, you know, and Kurt Cobain, I guess, and whatever. But I like the idea that it happens to be at their Saturn returns. It's like Saturn comes back around, and then they're like, these happen to be people that like are echoing through time. You know, I mean, there's other people that echo through time that don't die on their Saturn returns as well. But they definitely, like, it feels like that was kind of like a peg or something. They like kind of worked their way into history through that. It's trippy.
Yeah, very much. And especially with all the, you know, there's the whole element of conspiracy surrounding those deaths, all of them. Now, granted, that might just be an unwillingness to accept something terrible. But the fact that it's clouded could give credence to this whole, when the king dies, we should have his voice. It should echo throughout the ages, right? When Kennedy died, ask not what your country can do for you, what you can do for your country. Did people wake up the next day and say, I'm going to honor that to the rest of my days because our king was brutally murdered? Did people still maintain that in their conscience? Or do you have what happened in the 80s? People just divorcing their bank account from what it meant to their country. You know, CEOs of corporations taking work out of the country. They were not asking what they can do for their country. They were asking what they could do for themselves. So I don't know what that, how this dovetails into the whole King Kill theories. But I look forward to when Alan completes his book to get a better perspective on it, because I think he's right there with it.
Have you read some of his book?
Yeah, I have. I've read some of who's the James Shelby Downard.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the language I have to work hard to get past with that. But I'm sort of approaching the King Kill body of knowledge. I'm sort of, it's almost like a gravity point that's bringing me in. It's sort of something I wasn't really interested in, but now everything I'm reading is, it says you need to look at this again because it's tying into a lot of threads.
Yeah, there's a version of the Golden Bough that I guess the I'm pulling it out. So it's Sir J.G. Frazier, and I guess as far as I remember, it's funny, I open it up and it's all Dionysus. his kids or one of his children redid it because, so this is an example of something where it's not like Sitchin, where there's like purposeful manipulation. There's things that aren't entirely accurate, which is just what happens when you're compiling this much information. And so I believe he did his best, but they've actually like to keep in line, like they made all these shifts to the Golden Bough. They redid it years later, and you can get that version if you want. I really like that they're like, let's keep up with the times. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it's such obscure stuff, and he went and visited these places to try and get the information. He was just talking to people, and that's how he got a lot of it. And so to try and maintain accuracy through that is rather difficult. Across the board, it's just one of these things, you know. And so you know, he's as much of an expert as he could be, but if you look at this, if you get into the Golden Bough and start reading, you'll start to see it show up in places. And that's like, even if you don't read this but you're aware to any degree, you'll start to see it. And so when you read it, it's even more so. But like, this is like, as pointed out with our friend at the Subliminal Synchrosphere, you know, Silence of the Lambs and Apocalypse Now are just to name a couple, but there's a number, are just so overt with the symbolism. It's no mistake, and it really enriches it. It's like those 3D glasses we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
A whole other level to the story. Yeah. But yeah, no, I really like it, and I really am excited to see the finished product of Alan's book. And I couldn't agree with Alan more. That's funny. I just accidentally said I couldn't agree with Alan more. little sink wink there to Thelemite, but with that, he was saying that everything's pushing him towards it. So it's like he's studying things, and it's like, okay, I guess this is where I'm supposed to go with it. I had the exact same experience where you're studying all this stuff, and then everything keeps kind of going in that direction. I mean, if you approach, you can see the influence on Crowley heavily. The Golden Bough had a huge impact on him, and you can see the way that it's even worked into the tarot deck, which is admittedly so. I mean, it's in the Book of Thoth. He makes that no secret. I can't remember. I think maybe the Fool, he's going into it where he acknowledges that the Fool is the person who takes the Golden Bough.
Mm-hmm.
That interprets the Fool, that it's the outsider, that people have a whole, like, and that for me really like pushed the idea of like that the kingdom has a certain inertia, and that you need some outside element in order to rejuvenate it. And they literally looked at that as rejuvenating the tree. Because if it stayed within the same exact system and there was no outsider, if there was no Fool to throw things off, if there was no Zero, that it would basically turn into a dying tree. The tree would die.
Yeah.
But in order to flourish, you have to do this. And so I find it really interesting that the attachment of keeping the fool out of the system now, how it's actually killing the tree. And then I relate that to the idea of the tower and what's being communicated by the tower being opposite Romulus and Remus in the lover's card when you arrange Crowley's version of the hero's journey. The way that his numerical setup shifts things. Although it does seem to be the same numerical setup for the most part as Marseille. It's the rider deck that switched it, and he switched it back. And that was something I didn't actually catch until I was just happened to be looking at my Marseille tarot, and I noticed that the numbers of lust, strength, la force, is actually the same as Crowley's. And I'm like, oh, okay. I mean,
so if you have three tarot decks lined up in three lines, you'd have 78, 78, 78, right? Mm-hmm. So the 216, which is the three verses of 72, 72, 72, right? If you compare those two, this tarot would have six and six and six, oh, like too much. You know what I'm saying?
Huh. Yeah. Six and six and six, too much.
But like, do you think that has any significance on any level, or
it might? It never occurred to me to think like that.
Because when I do the Kubrick thing, I have one verse would be 2001, one verse would be The Shining, one verse would be The Wall. Each section has 82 minutes, and so you'd have your 72, but you'd have an extra 10. 10, 10, 10. And I was flashing on that today and thinking if, you know, I got to ponder on that and see what I make of it. But what is rock solid for me is that I have verse, 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 and then I'm combining it into one unified bigger number or bigger whole.
Well, I'm excited to watch 2001 A Space Odyssey with Capricorn 1. I was going to do a Jason Barrera style mashup.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like fun. If you know Capricorn 1?
Is that the Canadian thing, or?
I brought it up on the show before. It's with O.J. Simpson.
Okay, yeah.
Make a mission to Mars, and then basically it's these astronauts having to escape from the man, basically, through the desert. And it just, I don't know, it feels like they're the same length of time, the versions that I have. There's different versions, of course, but I like that kind. I'll see how enjoyable that is and get back to you.
Yeah.
Just the humor of, you know, the cover story, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to take it a different way, but what were you going to finish with right there?
Oh, I don't even know. I've been talking and then just kind of seeing what, like, where it wants to take me. Yeah, I'm in a weird space. But Capricorn, obviously, being the devil. And then you have Capricorn 1 relating to faking a mission. And I couldn't help but relate that to the devil's tower in Close Encounters of the Third Kind as well.
Mm-hmm.
Our actually, like, on Crowley's devil card, the phallus in it looks so much to me like the devil's tower in Close Encounters, where they have the alien contact. And so it's kind of an interesting idea there.
I mean, the only place that you can have alien contact is in three dimensions. Because once you get to the fourth dimension, there's no such thing as alien, because it's all known. It's either all alien, therefore not alien, or all is...
That's exactly it. So I'm thinking, like, Iowa's, Oz relating to, like, everything Crowley has to say about the lust card, and then that happens to be the dweller at the threshold. It seems like when you're watching Contact and they fold the message to create the cube,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to think outside the cube. Same thing with Stargate, how they take the seventh point of the cube as the transcendent point to fold space, you know? And so, mm-hmm. like, the dune worm in Folding Space, which is itself the spice, is also the wormhole, right? So you have, like, the wormhole on the tree is literally that point, because that's the force. That's the force that is between the two poles, like the magnet. So if you like put the magnet together so that like as it's pushing itself apart, if you turned it around, it could pull it together. It's the idea. Like that's how I look at the force, like why it's the force. And so if you say the dark side of the force, that's the side of the force is pushing it apart. Or depending on how you look at it, it could be what's pulling. But that it's like who knows which is which and who is who, you know, but in the always round and round. But I like relating to it in that way. There's something really interesting there, thinking about that it's Metatron is atop that point, or this stands at the threshold of Metatron's, you know, gulf that's separating the thing from itself. And so to fold space-time requires that you take the knowledge and allow the knowledge to collapse into itself, which is literally to allow the power to collapse, which is structure. It's pretty trippy.
Every time we disagree, I'm struck by a rivalry, color-coded contraries. I wrote a song, it's not about you. Miss her man there when I met at my booth.